Hi, this is Rich Lucy in the Drug Enforcement Administration's Community Outreach and Prevention Support section, and welcome to this episode of Prevention Profiles Take 5. I'm excited to have as our guest today, Allison Smith from the Louisiana Board of Regents. Let me tell you a little bit about Allison before she joins the podcast. After spending 8 years with the Louisiana Center addressing substance use in collegiate communities on the Louisiana State University campus, Dr. Allison Smith is currently the program administrator for the Louisiana Center at its new home, the Louisiana Board of Regents. In her current role, Allison facilitates the Louisiana Higher Education Coalition, administers the statewide core survey, provides professional development training, facilitates campus community partnerships, and provides technical assistance around substance use prevention in Louisiana's colleges. She also supports the broader campus safety policy work and initiatives of the Louisiana Board of Regents. Allison's experience includes internships with both the Nurse Family Partnership and the Center for Substance Abuse Prevention. Dr. Smith, a native of Baton Rouge, received a bachelor's degree in psychology from Southern University in 2009, a master's degree in public administration from Louisiana State University in May 2011, followed by a doctoral degree in educational leadership, research, and counseling with a specialization in higher education administration in 2016. And with that, Allison, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. Good afternoon. Good morning, Rich.
This is a very exciting because, you know, as we'll get into a little bit, I've known you for now going on 10 years or so. Before I get into our first question, first, I want to say thank you for all that you do on social media to promote DEA's prevention resources for colleges and universities. I think I've kiddingly said on more than one occasion, I feel like sometimes you're my unofficial publicist. And it's just great to see the different tweets that you send out and the other social media posts that you put out, you know, really promoting and seeing the benefit of what we're trying to do to help prevent drug misuse on campus. So thank you very much for that.
You're more than welcome. I am extremely excited with all of the resources you all pull out. One that I like not having to reinvent the wheel, and you all make that very easy to do.
Well, we appreciate that. So thank you very much. So I'm going to jump right into our first question. So having gone through, you know, your very impressive bio, you know, throughout all the different positions that you've had during your career, both as a student and now as a professional, how has your perspective changed, if at all, as it relates to preventing drug misuse among college students?
I'd have to say two things have probably been constant. One, that you've probably heard me scream about or tweet about anyway, is the Drug-Free Schools and Campuses Act, and the other one is harm reduction. By nature, I like good policies because I believe they help to inform the work we do to mitigate harm and to help us not have to reinvent the wheel constantly. So yes, this is me shouting from the rooftop that I hope that an update to DFSCA will be coming really soon. Because one, I think that helps to give everyone a level playing field to where we should be, a standard to where we should go. And I think secondly, the idea of harm reduction. So I kind of stumbled my way into this field. So a funny story, Rich mentioned that we've kind of known each other almost 10 years at this point, is that I applied for an internship through the National Association for Equality in Higher Education. And the way it works is they find paid internships for students from underrepresented populations from HBCUs and minority serving institutions. And part of that, I got placed at SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration in CSAP. When I got the call, my supervisor at the time, Nelly Nadal, I had to hold on. She let me hold on to Google CSAP because I thought it was a prank. I had no idea about prevention related before that particular call. It's been an amazing experience since, but the only thing I had known before that was zero tolerance. What I was taught through K-12, zero tolerance, not really looking at the idea of harm reduction. And for me, that's been something working with our campus community coalitions, our community partners, is educating them on the difference of harm reduction versus zero tolerance. And I think once we begin to get honest about the fact that we do have students who are misusing substances on our campuses, that will allow us to craft creative and relevant programming or messaging to reduce the harm. And one other thing that I'm noticing is that now we're starting to have to go back to some of those basic things that were done 20, 30 years ago, teaching students about blood alcohol content. What do the lines on the red Solo cups mean? Or what is binge drinking? What are signs of alcohol poisoning? And informing them of any amnesty policies that your campuses or state may have in case they need to seek help for someone who's experiencing intoxication or an overdose.
Well, boy, you touched on two major issues, and I'm really glad that you did. Certainly, I cannot speak for another federal agency in updating their policy or guidance around the Drug-Free Schools and Communities Act, but I will say this. It's been over 12 years or so since I worked there and worked with colleges and universities very closely on their requirements under those regulations. And, you know, even though the guidance document hasn't changed at all, what I continue to promote for folks is the basic principle of the Drug-Free Schools and Communities Act is still so relevant because of it's grounded in prevention science that it makes sense every couple of years to check in with what you're doing to make sure it's effective.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, that is, I think, really important. On your other point of harm reduction, boy, I have, I don't want to say struggled, but it's such a slippery slope when you work in government. And my entire career has been working for government, both at the New York State level and then now for the last 20 plus years with the federal government. Every leader I've worked for in those agencies, whether at Department of Ed, whether it was at CSAP, certainly with Fran, I've dropped Fran's name on this podcast so many different times. Fran Harding, the former director of CSAP, who's not only a dear friend of mine, but my mentor now at DEA. You know, the issue of harm reduction is such, it's a compromising, if you will, philosophy or concept. What I've always tried to impress upon my leaders is to say absolutely 100%, our first message should be a non-use message. I mean, if we're talking alcohol, it's non-use if you're under the age of 21. No matter what state you're in that has legalized marijuana, despite the fact that, yes, marijuana is a illegal drug federally across the entire country. Even in those states who have legalized it, it's illegal for those under 21. Our first message has to be non-use. But, you know, what I always say is, you know, for those students who choose to ignore the law, and that's really what it comes down to, we have to be able to work with colleges and universities on the types of messaging and programming that they can have for those students, because they can't just ignore them. and that has seemed to resonate, I think, with the leaders I've worked for very well. So I'm glad, Allison, that you brought that up, because I know it's a struggle you also face on campus.
Yes, that's absolutely. That's been the message, is that the non-use is the first message, but it can't be the only message. So in one, right. We have students who are having usage issues. We need to be able to, one, identify those students and provide resources to them that know that it's not always the case, but we need to, it has to be multiple messages. I know one thing that talking with other statewide coalitions is messaging during the time of COVID, because one, we know that students shouldn't, like you said, under 21, it's non-use message, but we know that because in a lot of our states, bars are closed right now currently. And so that students are gathering other places, not just even the dangers with COVID, social distancing, those types of things. About one, we still have to message around usage in those types of settings, that we can't ignore that.
And this, it's going to segue into my second question, but let me comment since you brought it up. Obviously, we're recording this as we continue, all of us in the country, to confront the pandemic that's facing us. And because we are at the beginning of the traditional school year, we are starting to see the reports of student gatherings, student parties. Some schools had planned to open up and they did, and now they've reversed course. And I think what I would hope is that when we're talking about the large gatherings and these parties and we're talking about COVID, I would hope we don't lose also the focus on the preventing drug misuse issue, because it's not, you know, it's not only about COVID, right? I mean, it's where is the messaging that we should be continuing to promote about preventing underage drinking and this other dangerous behavior, right?
Absolutely, because one of the reasons why, so our governor, John Bel Edwards, one of the things he noted about our bars are still currently closed right now, we're in phase two, but one of the things he noticed that the nature of bars themselves allow for the spread of COVID to intensify. But we also don't forget the reason why students are in the bars in the first place. They're there for the social interaction, and a lot of them are there to drink. And so one, right, like you said, we cannot lose that messaging that it's no different than any other fall semester, that these first six weeks are as dangerous as any other fall semester, those first 6 weeks. That hasn't changed.
Absolutely. That's such an important message. And I'm really glad that you brought that up and that we continue to talk about it, because I'm fearful that that messaging gets lost in the conversation, and it can't get lost. I had mentioned, you opened up a good segue into the second question having to do with statewide initiatives. So I know that one of the roles that you have is to coordinate Louisiana's statewide initiative to prevent drug misuse among college students, something I had that role of doing years ago when I did work for Fran in New York. What is perhaps the biggest challenge that you see or have with coordinating efforts across an entire state?
So Rich, I know you love the SPIF, and I will pull from there and say capacity. We have four public higher education systems, including the only HBCU system in the world, the Southern University system, to our robust technical and community college system, to our all four-year University of Louisiana system, and to the LSU system, which is comprised of two and four-year institutions, as well as health science centers. And so our capacity varies greatly on where any of those given schools are or at any given time on prevention. And so our Board of Regents has designation over all public colleges. But to add to all of that, we also have the Louisiana Association of Independent Colleges and Universities, which are private or religious affiliated institutions, 10 of those institutions that we engage at their leisure. And so we have some campuses that are much further along in their prevention efforts than others. So it's my job to always remember that. So when I'm looking at programming or professional development and technical assistance, being able to bring everybody along. And although it's probably my biggest challenge, I like to think of it as my biggest opportunity. For me, it's a chance to show the schools who are developing their prevention programs by highlighting the ones who offer more robust programming and making resources available through ongoing technical assistance and professional development. So an example is that, this month is recovery month. And so last year we celebrated with Southeastern Louisiana University to launch Line Up Recovery, which is the first collegiate recovery program in Louisiana. And really championing that effort has led to other schools who have expressed interest in starting a collegiate recovery program, as well as brought in some funding from the Louisiana Department of Health, Office of Behavioral Health, with whom we've had a phenomenal partnership with for almost 15 years. And so those kinds of things, now championing, showing the other campuses what's possible, is allowing this idea of collegiate recovery to spread across our state. So in 2019, the Louisiana Board of Regents passed its new 10-year master plan for higher education, which calls for us to move aggressively forward towards a robust new attainment goal that calls for 60% of all working age adults, those 25 to 64 in Louisiana, to hold a degree or high value credential by 2030. One way our work fits into this is by helping to expand our vision of talent in the prosperity pipeline through increasing collegiate recovery in Louisiana and identifying students who may have stopped their matriculation due to substance misuse and saying, hey, now we have resources that can help support you through your college journey onto completion, and being able to pull those students in, get them plugged into programs that they can attain their degree or other high value credential.
So there's two parts to this I wanted to mention. So capacity, I'm so glad that you brought that up. You know, it was not only from my time in New York, but certainly now since my time working at CSAP, where, you know, of course, the SPIF generated out of SAMHSA 20 plus years ago, and now through the strategic planning guide that we published earlier this year, which is anchored in the SPIF, I still think, you know, when I talk to campuses around the country, the one step of the SPIF that they, I think they, you know, seem to struggle with the most is around capacity. And for me, I think where they struggle is they think it's rooted in money. And, you know, I'm not going to disagree that certainly having a grant, federal, state, local, that helps. I totally get it. But, you know, when I worked in New York, it was really just my salary. We didn't have any other funds to help support and do all the other great things we were doing across the state. Do you see this and hear the same thing when across even the four different systems, regardless of their state of readiness, that their struggles with capacity is based more on money, is it, or are there other factors?
So I think a little bit of both. I think so for overall for our state coalition, I've personally said for years that I don't think money is our problem. That I feel like we have enough resources to do the things that we've been tasked to do. I do feel like that in that sense. But I think more so it's the human capacity. I think kind of that where money could be tied into the actual staff people. So we have liaisons at all of our campuses, and those liaisons, depending on what campus they are on, they may have a number of different job titles. And it's so they may be a counselor, but they're also someone who works, who teaches, who does multiple things. And I think part of it is, one, understanding that you don't have to do it all yourself, that if you form strong partnerships and collaborations, you can bring other people in so that all of the weight doesn't fall on you. And I think that's part of where the Drug-Free Schools and Communities Act comes in, doing that buy-in and review, bringing everybody to the table to see what everybody is doing. Because one, even in doing some of those with our campuses, they found out there's a duplication of services where they can partner together, have a bigger event and have a bigger impact, where they can stop struggling alone to individually do events, but to work together and cut out some of the duplication of services.
Well, certainly in your role, that's one of the things you're keen to, you're aware of, is the duplication of effort. You've used the phrase, as we often hear, you know, certainly in federal government, of reinventing the wheel. You know, it's helping to not duplicate those services and leverage the resources where they exist.
Absolutely. And so when I talk about capacity, we have some campuses that, just given the financial standing or the structure of the campus, is that one of our challenges that we're looking at our state is the number of mental health counselors we have on our campuses available to our students, and how that kind of ties into substance use. One of the things we've seen is that we have some campuses where there's not a full-time counselor. There's not full-time staff that are dedicated to seeing students, that they have to refer out to community partners. And so instead of having like the part-time counselor, someone at that campus overburdened, it's our job to help facilitate that strong community partnership where they can have a contact that they can refer students to, so that students do not have to wait for services or things of that sort, but being able to rely on your community partners in a place where you may have a deficit.
So, still staying on the topic of statewide initiatives, you mentioned, you know, of course, September being Recovery Month, and you mentioned some of the efforts that's happened there in the state. Is there anything, else that you're especially proud of with Louisiana's statewide efforts?
Yes, I am super excited. In June of this year, our Board of Regents passed the Board of Regents Opioid Education, Training, and Reporting Policy. It was such an amazing all hands on deck process to be a part of. And it was a collaborative process between our office, our four public management systems, the Office of Behavioral Health, and our local governing entities, which function as our regional behavioral health offices. The policy is a great step forward in prevention measures to help keep Louisiana's college students safe from negative consequences of substance use, while teaching our students and campus community members the dangers of opioid misuse and abuse, and places the life-saving drug naloxone on every public campus in Louisiana as recommended by the Office of National Drug Control Policy. Something else really, there's three main components to the policy. It requires every campus to have an educational awareness campaign around the dangers of opioid misuse. So before COVID, the interruption of COVID, we were actually going around to our state doing regional trainings, utilizing the Ohio State University's Generation RX program, teaching our campuses that program, providing training manuals, resources for our campus to implement. We'll resume some of those virtually as we still aren't allowed to meet yet. And then additionally, the policy requires training certain persons on campus annually on how to administer naloxone, such as campus law enforcement, counselors, athletic trainers, resident advisors, or those who would be most likely to respond in an overdose situation. And lastly, there's a reporting requirement that campuses will have to complete after an on-campus naloxone administration, as well as a quarterly report. Two main goals of this policy is one, to help erase the stigma of those who are in recovery and highlight resources available for those who may be battling addiction. And then the last one, the shortest one, I think is the most simple. Whenever someone asks me to describe the policy, it's to not have the misuse or abuse of opioids derail the future of any of Louisiana's college students.
Wow. So, you know, I can appreciate why that is such a reason to celebrate a success. So you mentioned four different government agencies coming together to work on this, and certainly I've had that experience. That's not easy. You know, getting four government, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've heard, you know, people criticizing the government saying, even when I worked in the state, you all need to work together. Well, first of all, I think you have to reset your perception that we aren't. I mean, we collaborate a lot more than people think that we do, but
absolutely,
it's hard. I mean, and I think that that's no different than some of the collaboration that's happening at the local level that campuses try to do with the community, right? I mean, I think we model that in some respect.
Yes. And so for us, that kind of what that process looked like is initially we kind of started out, our office worked with our poor public management systems and our representative from the private colleges. So our public colleges are mandated through our policy, but the private colleges can opt in, and a lot of them have chosen to. And so it started with us and the four public management systems and the private liaison. We all worked together to craft the policy, what that would look like. And then the Office of Behavioral Health provided all of the funding to purchase the kits. And then our local governing entities, which are our regional behavioral health offices, they serve as pickup points for our campuses in those areas to pick up their kids. And if they need in-person training, we have staff at the regional, the local governing entities that can go in and facilitate trainings for those campuses as well. And so one, it's a partnership where everybody is working to assist in the main goal. And I think I've heard you say it a couple of times, is that one, and something I truly believe in, is that you need to seek to serve. How do you help other people? If you're going to have a partnership, there has to be something in it for everyone. It can't just always be about what do you get out of this.
Right. So what I heard you say is, we know from successful collaboration, it sounds like everybody had a role and everybody knew what their role was.
Yes.
Yeah. So I'll move on to our third question, and this is so timely. You know, you and I have talked a little bit since last week. You work in a part of the country that is regularly affected by hurricanes, and this past year was no exception. In fact, you know, when we're taping this on September 3rd, Hurricane Laura hit the Gulf Coast last week. So first of all, I need to ask, how are you doing and how have the schools fared in the state?
I am well, and thank you for asking. And I'm pretty sure I can speak for the entire state of Louisiana and say we appreciate you for asking. A couple of our schools in a lot of the communities in Southwest and Central Louisiana have been severely impacted by Hurricane Laura. It's been really inspiring to see some of our unimpacted campus communities pull together and donate resources to those in need. And I'm sure that will be a continued ongoing effort for some time. There's a lot of just devastation there. I don't think that we've yet seen what may or may not be the impact of this natural disaster on substance use there. Right now, lots of people are still in shock and just trying to still get their bearings.
Right. Yeah, I mean, so for those of us who we see, and it's not just the Gulf Coast. I mean, it's certainly, you know, I talked to Katrin Westner. They got hit last year. Was Hurricane Florence, I believe, and you at North Carolina and Wilmington. Schools and towns that have been hit by tornadoes and such. You know, those of us, we see it on the news. But, you know, I don't think that that truly can do justice to what it actually, the impact it actually has at the ground level in person and actually seeing the true impact of something like that.
Yeah, it's a sight to behold. And yeah. It's like a lot of the pictures don't do it justice. I have a lot of friends there who are there working on some recovery efforts, and just the pictures that they've seen, that one, just trying to one. And what's been really interesting is that because it, particularly in Lake Charles, those campuses there, we have two campuses there that were affected, Sowell Technical Community College and McNeese State University. Those campuses are really big community hubs there. And so one, being able to get those back up and running and be able to let them get back to some of their duties of providing community resources and space for community things to go on there has been phenomenal to watch the community, the other campus communities rally around those campuses.
Well, you know, my follow on this question is that, you know, we know that substance use rates can and do increase after a traumatic event, such as, you know, Hurricane Laura. And even during stressful times, and you know, COVID certainly fits that bill. And we've heard the stories of alcohol and other drug use rates going up during this stressful time. Do you get that sense? I mean, this is not new. Certainly, as I mentioned, you're in an area of the country where, you know, it seems like almost every year when it's storm season, we hear about tropical depressions and tropical storms that evolve into hurricanes that head for the Gulf Coast. So it's not new to the region of the country, but do you get the sense among the state's campuses around this issue about substance use connected to these types of events, and what are some of the strategies that they use to address it?
One, I was hoping by this point we would be able to see kind of hear from our campuses kind of what they've seen. But one, I don't think we've been able to see yet. And so for us, the disruption of the hurricane, whatever was going to be a sort of new pattern that we were seeing with students was even upended by the hurricane.
Right.
And so one, a lot of our states shut down in advance of the hurricane. And Louisiana, mm-hmm. like you said, we're familiar with hurricanes. And so there's a very common concept of called hurricane parties. And so when people gather and they just kind of hang out, cook, or especially if someone loses power, they will cook all the food in their freezers and things like that so that it doesn't spoil anything. But the gathering, which was also a concern during COVID. And so I know as a field, we were just really concerned about what COVID would look like on the fall semester. And I don't think we've grasped it yet. Mm-hmm. I don't think we've begun to tap the surface. And I know one of the things I know me and some of the other statewide coalition leaders had discussed is that when students were abruptly sent home during the spring semester, a lot of them tapered their usage when we were worried about when they got back to campus and they had been home for a couple of months, will most likely decrease usage. When they got back around a group of their peers, what would their uses look like? And so I know just one, being concerned about if there are spikes and things like that, tolerance levels, but I don't think we'll fully see the impact yet until at least September 26th when SEC football is set to begin. So a lot of conferences are not playing. So we know a lot of our HBCU, our SWAC conference here, they're not playing until the spring semester, but the SEC is set to begin football on September 26th.
Okay. And there's been a lot of talk about that.
Yes, they're set to begin. That may change, but they're set to begin. And we know the conversation around what does tailgating look like and how will that impact our student experience, their usage rates. But in anticipation of any spikes in usage, our strong partnership with the Office of Behavioral Health has allowed us, we're currently working on acquiring ScreenU, which is from the Higher Education Center for Alcohol and Drug Misuse Prevention and Recovery at The Ohio State University. And it will allow our campuses to assign a web-based expert tool to screen not only for prescription drug misuse, but also for alcohol and marijuana use disorder. And this will help us quickly identify students in need, and if necessary, depending on the capacity of the campus, we can get them referred out to some of our amazing local governing entities and other community partners. And so we're working on building an infrastructure in case we do start to see an influx. I mentioned earlier, we know we have a short of mental health counselors on our campus that we can start to, get students screened and referred out quickly, or those students brought into, if they need physical appointments instead of virtual appointments, things of that sort.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've had this conversation with, our peers on other podcast episodes and just in other meetings and such, that I guess from a research perspective, if you're a researcher and you're doing data, I can imagine the size of the asterisk that goes next to 2020, right? I mean, it just is such an anomaly year that it's going to be really difficult to figure out how the data fits in, right?
Absolutely.
I think it's
difficult. Yeah. Absolutely. Like I said, I mentioned that the SEC is set to play football this fall, but we have another conference, and I believe we may have a second one that is set to play in the spring. We do the core alcohol and drug survey in the spring of every odd year. And so that data will definitely have an asterisk next to it when we moved a lot of our fall activities there. And then another, again, the impact of COVID that we're looking at doing completely online, because we have some campuses that still do paper and pencil, but we don't even know if our systems will allow their campuses to have paper pencil surveys in the classrooms in the spring. So just one, it will definitely have a huge asterisk next to our 2021 data set. That will come with a lot of explanations.
So I'm going to move on to our fourth question. Throughout my career I've worked 29 years or so in the prevention field. And I often hear that, certain types of schools and student populations are underrepresented, underserved, we certainly know that, in terms of available data and evidence-based programs. And certainly HBCUs and other minority-serving institutions, Hispanic-serving, tribal colleges, Asian American, Pacific Islander, they certainly, fit within that rubric of being underrepresented, underserved. So in your work there in Louisiana, and the work that you've even maybe done across the country with other schools, are there any HBCUs or other minority serving institutions that you would like to highlight that have done a really good job in transforming maybe what's traditional prevention or recovery services and made them work for their unique campus population?
I think there's two amazing programs at HBCUs to highlight, and I think they're the collegiate recovery programs at North Carolina A&T and Virginia Union University. Dr. Vivian Barnett and Dr. C.J. Clemens at NCAT, which is North Carolina A&T, and Dr. Shanita Brown at Virginia Union University have all done an amazing job taking evidence-based and evidence-informed practices and adapting them to culturally relevant programs for their unique student populations, such as Basics and Casics, or even running smart recovery meetings on their Instagram Live, which I think is a phenomenal idea. And Dr. CJ made a really great point during her joint presentation at ARHE, the Association of Recovery and Higher Education, that she completed with Dr. Shanita Brown. And she said, cultural relevance is happening if what you do and how you do it is relevant to the population that you serve. And I think as a field, we'll have to explore the idea of who gets to decide what is evidence-based or evidence-informed, and making sure that our programming reflects the culture and diversity of our student bodies. And I think one really critical aspect of North Carolina A&T's program is that they found ways to involve their band. In HBCU culture, the band is huge. A lot of SEC schools, you see the football team is huge. It is the opposite at HBCU cultures. The band is huge. That is a huge piece. Mm-hmm. My only point of disagreement with them is that their band is not better than the Southern University marching the human jukebox. That is my running joke with them, the human jukebox of the Southern University with my alma mater. But they found ways to integrate things such as R&B relaxation or trap yoga or things of that sort, places where they can get students into a space where they're able to give them the same programming just under a different setting or settings that make the students feel more comfortable. And they talk a lot about engaging the whole family when in the recovery process for students, that it's not just the students. Recognizing the strong affiliation with families, getting families to buy into the program to help make the student have a better overall chance of success.
So, you know, when we released the strategic planning guide back in January, and I know you're a strong proponent of the strategic prevention framework, and we continue to talk about one of the underlying foundations of the SPIF is cultural competence. And when we were preparing the guide and it was in review, I don't know if it's a new concept that was, you know, new for colleges, not universally, because I do think some colleges and universities were aware of the concept of cultural humility, which is something I actually had to learn a little bit more about. It actually came from one of our interns. And talking about this issue of you need to address cultural humility maybe before you can even get to being culturally competent. This idea of regularly checking in with inherent or implicit biases that we possess, and sometimes I think don't even realize we possess. Is that something that that you recognize or is helpful to campuses in the issue of cultural competence?
Absolutely, and that's actually, I believe it was Dr. C.J. Clemens at NCAT who mentioned it in one of her presentations that I've seen, is that one, and Dr. Vivian Barnett has mentioned it, that understanding that even though your students may come from a different world from you, understanding what that means and being willing to learn from them. And Dr. Vivian Barnett talked a lot about when you see students that understanding the role, I think she made a really good point, understanding the role that faith plays in a lot of students in HBCUs, minority serving institutions, plays in their life, mm-hmm. no matter what the faith is, understanding the cultural relevance, the importance and the impact of that, and being able to understand, listen, kind of walk in their shoes a little bit and understand why it plays such a big part in their journey.
Right. You know, I'm glad you mentioned that, because certainly even if you look at the risk and protective factors model for prevention, certainly, you know, even when I worked for Fran in New York and such, and we were looking at identifying those types of factors, you know, we would talk about the issue of faith. And for campuses that are primarily, you know, Southern, right? I mean, I'm coming from New York State and learning the fact that religiosity and spiritual connection is such a strong protective factor with it, you know, in the HBC community. And then I'm glad that you brought that up, because that is something that is a strong connection to prevention efforts.
Absolutely. And that's something that we see with our HBCUs that participate in our survey here. And so our campuses, they can participate with our coalition without, it's completely funded by us. There's nothing they pay for. We pay for the core alcohol drug survey if they want to complete it, but it's not mandatory to receive any services from our coalition that they participate in the survey. But one of the things we see with our HBCUs that their drinking rates tend to be lower than predominantly white institutions. We see that. Right. And then also one that they tend to have a pretty consistent or increased marijuana consumption rate, but right. also looking at the cultural impact of that, the cultural relevance. We have students who identify as Rastafarian, things like that. What type of cultural impact do those bring to student substance use? So when just kind of considering those things, and again, like I said, reminding them that, yes, it is federally illegal. It falls under the legal schedule. It is still illegal federally.
Right. Right. Well, as we start to wrap up here and I move on to our fifth question, which is pretty much the same question I'd like to ask of all of our guests as we start to wrap up. And that's to ask you, what would you say to encourage the professionals, your colleagues who are working to prevent drug misuse among college students, as well as the students themselves, because we know that they are also listening to this podcast?
I have six quick little things I will leave you with. The first one is many hands make a light load. I truly believe this. There's no way that I'm better alone. The second is this is definitely a marathon and not a sprint. So pace yourself, especially in a global pandemic. You deserve the grace you give your students and your peers. The third one, this work is hard, but not impossible. And what you do does make a difference. The fourth would be embrace the partnerships you have and cultivate the ones you need for future collaborations. The fifth, be sure to pour into the next generation of prevention professionals. You have a lot to offer. And the last one, the sixth one would be celebrate your wins. I'm sure you worked hard for them.
Wow, I love what you, and you know I talk in sound bites sometimes. you've just given us six. I just absolutely love that. You know, Allison, this interview has been all that I'd hoped for and more in everything that you bring to our field, bring to this conversation, the experiences that you've had, as I said, both as a student. I mean, I can't believe I was looking at, again, the timeline. Your internship at CSAP was 10 years ago this summer. I mean, I was like, really? Yes. 10 years ago? That's just amazing how time really does fly. But, you know, again, it's been excellent to have you join us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It has been an amazing experience.
Well, and I know that we'll be continuing our collaboration and partnership in the years to come in this work, which, as you've said, it is hard work. It's not impossible. Sometimes the highs are really high and the lows are really low. But, you know, the wins are really worth celebrating. And I think that's an awesome note to end this on. So, again, Allison, thank you very much. And to our listeners, I appreciate you and the work that you continue to do to make our campuses safe and healthy. And with that, I'm going to say thanks for listening and have a great day.